We go. Last week we left off on Daf Nun Beis Amud Beis. So I want to just sort of bring us back into what the discussion that was going on. Before I do that, let me just present sort of one background issue, which is the following. There is a prohibition of Me'ilah, which is to derive benefit from or to take something that belongs to the temple treasury. One aspect is the fact that there's a prohibition, but there's a second piece that comes along with it as well, which is that under many circumstances, violation of Me'ilah has another effect. Aside from the sinner having sinned and whatever the ramifications are, it also has the effect of profaning or being mechalel the object of hekdesh that I used, that I took, that I benefited from. Which means that, let's say, a person came along and he used a chair of hekdesh or something like that.
How would you define hekdesh?
Anything that was consecrated to the to the Beis HaMikdash. So, in theory, if in fact he violates the prohibition of Me'ilah with this chair, the chair may now become chulin, and now anybody can use it. He has to pay whatever the penalties are, but that fundamentally it's yotzei lechulin. The expression to be mechalel often means to redeem, which is the same word as chulin, which means something which does not have sanctity. Now the rule really is as follows. When we talk about hekdesh, there are two kinds of sanctity when it comes to the Beis HaMikdash. The first kind of sanctity is what's known as kedushas damim. It's an object whose value to the treasury is primarily that it has monetary value. So there are a lot of expenses the Beis HaMikdash has, and if someone gives their dining room set, they consecrate their dining room set to the Beis HaMikdash, the gizbar, the kohanim, are not going to eat off the dining room set. It's not going to become part of the furniture of the mikdash. That shulchan doesn't meet the criteria of the shulchan that's inside the heichal. Instead, the gizbar, the treasurer, will take the dining room set, he will sell it, and the money will go to hekdesh, and hekdesh...
Commodity,
but it means it's something, its value to hekdesh is only that of its monetary value. It's called kedushas domim. There's a second kind of hekdesh, which is called kedushas haguf, where the object itself has inherent sanctity, where its value, it's useful in the service within the Beis HaMikdash. And there are, generally speaking, two primary things that fall under this. Maybe there could be some other things. They are, number one, an animal which doesn't have a mum, it doesn't have a blemish. And once it's consecrated, it is supposed to be brought as a karban. An animal which is designated as a karban and has no mum in it can never be redeemed. You can try, it doesn't work. In fact, the only thing that the Torah does speak about, which my kids would describe as an epic fail, is of a person who tries to make a tamura. He tries to swap in one animal for another animal. The original animal retains its full kedusha. The second animal gets most of that kedusha. So you cannot redeem an animal which is kadosh lamizbeach because it has kedusha saguf. Until the animal gets a mum, it cannot be redeemed at all. And by the way, even when that animal gets a mum, if you take an animal and you consecrate it as a karban while it does not have a mum, so it gets this full kedushas haguf, this full bodily sanctity, and then it gets a mum, then you redeem it, but it still retains a lot of its kedusha. What you're allowed to do with it now is to slaughter it and eat it, and anybody can eat it. Pure, tamei, tahar, pure, ritually pure, impure, Jew, non-Jew, anybody can eat it, anywhere. But the only thing that you're allowed to do with it is to shecht it and eat it. You're not allowed to shear its wool if it's a sheep. You're not allowed to work with it if it's an ox. If it dies without a shechita, you can't feed it to your dogs. You have to bury it. In other words, even the animal that got a mum, it still retains its kedusha saguf, so that when you redeem it, it still basically has most of its kedusha, but you don't bring it as a karban. You slaughter it outside and eat it. As opposed to if you took an animal that had a mum in it, and you consecrate it, because it cannot be brought as a karban by definition when it has a mum, it never gets what's called kedushas haguf. It only gets kedushas damim. From the moment you sanctify it, you consecrate it, the gizbar knows what is he going to do with that animal. So he's going to sell it to someone. And therefore, when you sell that animal, the buyer can do, when you redeem that animal, it's really a sale, when you redeem it, you're basically exchanging the kedusha from the animal onto the money. You can do anything you want with the animal, because that animal never had kedushas haguf. So that's one kind, so one type of kedushas haguf is an animal for a carbon, and the second is clay shares. Klei Sharis means one of the vessels that was used actually in the service of the temple. So if I consecrate a chair, that's not a Klei Sharis. There's no use for that in the Beis HaMikdash. The Gizbar simply lets someone redeem it and takes the money and gives it to the treasury. But if a person, let's say, takes a gold fire pan and they dedicate it to the Beis HaMikdash, so that can be used in the Avodah. Or once something gets, let's say even the Gizbar has to buy something and they build something and they use it as the Avodah, that's a Kli Sharis. It's a, I don't know how we want to translate Kli Sharis. It's a what?
Accoutrement.
Somebody, Marshall, did you have a word for that? A Kli Sharis? You had a word.
Service vessel.
No, that was sensor.
So that was a particular kind. Okay, so that was a machta. Okay, so if you have a call it a service vessel. So if it's used in the Beis HaMikdash, that also has Kedushas HaGuf. Now, why does that matter in our context? It matters as follows. When you violate Me'ilah on something, as I said before, sometimes the object is Yotzei Lachulin. It becomes desanctified. And when does that happen? So there are two criteria that have to be met. Number one, it only works when a person violates Me'ilah b'shogeg, by accident. The punishment for violating Me'ilah on purpose, intentionally taking from the treasury, everybody agrees that you get lashes, you get malkos, if you were warned. And there's even one opinion, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who says that you get misa bidei shamayim. You get the heavenly death penalty. Not karis, it's a notch below whatever karis is, but you get misa bidei shamayim. Now, for shogeg, the punishment for shogeg, once you either steal a pruto or get hana, get benefit of a pruta, is that you have to bring a karban, and you have to pay back the benefit that you got, and you have to add on a fifth, what we would call a quarter, a fifth of the total. And that's the punishment. But one of the things that also comes along with me'ila, when done b'shogeg, is that the object is yotzei l'chulin. But the Mishnah says there are only two exceptions to that rule. The Mishnah in me'ila, I think in the fifth parak, says, ein mo'el achar mo'el, if two people use the same object in sequence, both do not violate Me'ilah with the exception of Behema and Klei Sharis. Meaning by most objects, in principle, when one person uses it, so that person violates Me'ilah, and now the object loses its sanctity. So the next person who uses it, he might be stealing from the first person, but he's certainly not stealing from Hekdesh. Except a Behema and a Klei Sharis, that if one person, let's say you have an ox which belongs to Hekdesh, and one person rides on the ox. He takes it for a ride around the Temple Mount, okay? In celebration that Jerusalem is now the capital of the State of Israel. Good, bad, or indifferent, but he's celebrating. He takes that ox for a joy ride around the Temple Mount. So in that case, the animal, he violates Me'ilah, assuming that the joy ride was worth more than a pruta, but the animal still retains its Kedusha. So the next person who takes the joy ride the next time around also violates Me'ilah. Same thing would be true if somebody used the Klei Sharis. If a person, theoretically, I suspect, took a donkey and rode the donkey around the Temple Mount as a joyride, so the donkey does not have Kedushas HaGuf LaMizbeach, because a donkey cannot be brought as a korban. It's neither kosher nor one of the kosher animals that exist that are designated as an animal which is a korban. So the first guy who rides the donkey, so the donkey is Yotzei L'chul, and the donkey now becomes not sanctified anymore. The person who takes, so he has to bring a korban Me'ilah. He has to bring the korban, the korban Asham that's brought for Me'ilah, but the second guy who takes the joyride around the Temple Mount on the donkey, so he gets off on that particular count.
What's the idea? It's like becoming disgraced if you use it for...
Yeah, in other words, you basically have been mechalalit through this use, through usage. Now, that's important in our particular context. The Gemara, so now let's come back to where we were in the Gemara. The Gemara had asked the following question. In the Temple of Onias in Egypt, right, on the assumption that it was not an idolatrous sanctuary. It was used, it was bringing to God. It was bringing to Yudke Vavke. It was a monotheistic religion worshiping the Jewish God. But you're not allowed to build your own temple outside of Jerusalem. So, but yet there was a temple. And so on the assumption that it was no Avodah Zarah, it was really L'shem Shamayim. So the Gemara wanted to know the following. The Mishnah at the end of Menachos says that a priest who ministered in that temple was disqualified from service in the temple in Jerusalem. Disqualified from serving in the Beis HaMikdash. That was only a rabbinic prohibition. A priest who ministers to idolatry is actually disqualified, probably min haTorah, probably scripturally from serving in the Mikdash, but one who only sacrificed outside the temple, because that's what the Temple of Onias is. It's not a Mikdash. All it means is that someone is taking karbanos, sacrifices, and bringing them outside the Beis HaMikdash. The punishment for bringing Shchutei Chutz is not that you, as a Kohen, you don't lose your right to work in the Beis HaMikdash.
Was it any worse that it was in Egypt, outside of Israel, than if it's done in Israel?
It's somehow, I don't think so.
Like a little, sort of really outside the precincts of the...
If anything, arguably is that there's a slight argument, slight silver lining, not really, but that it might be better outside of Eretz Yisrael. Like there's a possibility, again, it doesn't really matter here, there's a possibility that a Bechor that's born outside of the land of Israel cannot actually be brought in the temple. Which would mean that there'd be probably a greater leniency if you sacrificed it in America, because since it's not roi to bring on the Mizbeach, you're not going to be liable for the kares of shechting, in other words, the kares, the extreme penalty for shechting an animal outside of the temple, a sacrifice of the temple, is only if it's suitable to bring inside the temple. So I don't think that will matter here. Okay. Yes?
Is it that a Kohen who does sacrifice for Avodah Zarah can't serve in the Beis HaMikdash?
What's that?
A Kohen who does a sacrifice.
Yes.
Right. Don't you kill him?
No, let's say there was no witnesses, and now he does tshuva. Right? In other words, let's say he does a pshogeg. Let's say he does a pshogeg.
Okay, pshogeg
also. Yes, that would be true as well. But I, you know, and he could be a shogeg in the sense of he could be a tinok shenishba.
He thought it was okay.
He thought it was okay. He didn't realize that he was raised with that was part of his religion. I mean, by the way, you could imagine, it's not crazy, you could imagine, let's say someone is born, you know, a child in the Holocaust, right, and was raised as a Christian, had no idea, right, that's your Tinoch Shanishba case. And the question would be, I haven't decided for sure, but maybe next week, I don't know if people are going to, some people are going to be aware or not, but maybe I will try to, if I have the chance, prepare a special shiur on the topic that's been, you know, percolated last week and now again about Kohanim who kill by accident and Kohanim who serve Zara, can they duchen? Can they get up in Duchen? So maybe I'll try to see if I can prepare that for next Sunday. So we'll talk about that more then, or you'll hear it on the recording then more. So the Gemara says that the Kohan, and the Mishnah says that a priest who ministered in the Temple of Onias cannot minister in the Mikdash. He can eat kachim, but he cannot do avodah that is limited to Kohanim. I presume he can slaughter an animal, because I can also I'm not a Kohen, but I can slaughter an animal based on Mikdash, because Shechita can be done by a non-Kohen. But anything that requires a Kohen, that priest was disqualified from doing. So then the Gemara asked the following question. What about the vessels, the ministering vessels that were used in the Temple of Onias? Are you allowed to use those in the Mikdash? Or did the Rabbanon say, no, those they're tainted. You can't use them in the Mikdash because they were used in the Temple of Onias. Now, it only is going to be a rabbinic concern, because there's no prohibition of Hana associated with Shchutei Chutz, with things that are slaughtered outside the temple, and certainly vessels that are used outside the temple if they're not used for idolatrous purposes. So the question is, were the Chachamim, did they prohibit with a rabbinic gezerah on these vessels, or did they say no, that the priests who ministered are prohibited because they knew better, but the vessels didn't do anything wrong, the vessels are not b'nei dea, they don't know anything. So when this question was asked, Rebbe said, I had a pasuk, but I forgot what it was. And so then somebody asked, challenged Rebbe with the following pasuk. The pasuk that says that when Acha, yes, I know, but I have to, in order to, I'm not going to read it in text, but in order to go on, I really have to put it in frame. And we didn't discuss this particular piece, which is the following. Who did what with these vessels that Chizkiah was reconsecrating? The pasuk says that they came to Chizkiah and said all the kelim, which his father Achaz had done something with, you know, he had cast aside, so we prepared them and we sanctified them. So the question is, what did Achaz do with these kelim? What did he do with them? Presumably, his niach means to cast aside. But the Gemara is assuming there's something more. He must have used them for idolatrous ritual. And therefore, they reused them. So this ostensibly was to prove that the vessels that were used in the Temple of Onias could be reused. But there's a problem. Because if Achaz used these for idolatry, it's worse.
Yeah.
It's not just, in other words, it's not using them in the Temple of Onias. The assumption of the question of the Gemara was that if the vessels had been used, if the Temple of Onias were in fact an idolatrous temple, of course you wouldn't be allowed to use the vessels. The only possibility The only possibility was that maybe since they're not idolatrous, the rabbis didn't decree against it. So comes along the Gemara. So what's this question? So Rashi explains here that no. And this is the tricky part. Rashi explains that Ahaz, even though he used the vessels for Avodah Zarah, they didn't actually become prohibited min HaTorah. Why? Because he said, Ein Adam Oser Davar She'eno Shelo. Now, that's a sugya, by the way, we're going to have to talk about later, and probably in a few, several shurim down the line, Adafno and Dalin. This is a big debate, exactly what that means. How far does it mean, Ein Adam Oser Davar She'eno Shelo? For example, if I bow down to my behemoth, that behemoth becomes a nevad, and it can't be brought as a carbon. If you bow down to my behemoth, it doesn't become aser. But what if you do something to my behemoth? What if you pour yayin esach on the horns of my behemoth, or something like that, as part of consecrating my behemoth? What if you shecht my behemoth? Everybody would agree, if you shecht the behemoth, that's enough to make somebody else's object prohibited. In other words, there's a spectrum here, but the more of an action you do to the object, the more likely it is that you can make something prohibited, even though it doesn't belong to you. When you're totally passive, it's less likely that you can make an object usur that doesn't belong to you. So bowing down is about as passive as you get. I don't think anybody believes that if you bow down, I shouldn't say any, I don't know, maybe there's an opinion in the Gemara, but I don't think so, that if you bow down to someone else's behemoth, that becomes usur. Why? Because you didn't do anything to the behemoth, and it's not yours. So Ahaz took these vessels. He didn't actually change the vessels, but he did use them for idolatrous worship. So Rashi says that this is a case of Ein Adam Osa Davar She'eno Shelo. Some Rishonim claim here, the Ramban and the Rashba claim, that this Gemara would appear to be working only within one opinion later. That even when you do an action with the thing, that nonetheless it doesn't become Osir. So let's accept that premise. So therefore Rashi says the following. Since it's only Osir, since it's not Osir Min HaTorah, because Min HaTorah, a person can't make something prohibited that doesn't belong to him, but still, Ahaz did something that really wasn't appropriate with it, and yet, according to the questioner's reading, they reuse these vessels. So you see that that vessels that were used in the Temple of Onias, if they don't become prohibited Min HaTorah, then they can be used in the Beis HaMikdash. So in the Temple of Onias, remember, if that had been an idolatrous temple, those vessels would really be Osir, because nobody stole the vessels. That's what they were made for. But in the Beis HaMikdash, the vessels before Ahaz's time already were consecrated for proper use. Ahaz misused them. It doesn't really make them prohibited in HaTorah. And you see that the Chachamim did not prohibit it mid the Rabbanon.
But there are two different things. One is using...
Correct. One is using with permission something for Shechut Echot. One is using without permission something for Avodah Zarah. But neither of them is prohibited in HaTorah. So whoever asked this question, I think the questioner was probably Rabbi Yossi ben Shaul, was assuming that they should be equivalent. Since both are permitted min HaTorah, if the Rabbanon would have prohibited one, they would have prohibited the other. And if they don't prohibit one, it means they don't prohibit the other. And that's why you're allowed to... That's why you're allowed to use them. Now, Rebbe turns around and says, "Nah, I read the pasuk. Thank you. You returned my lost object. I read the pasuk differently, and the pasuk, in fact, means the way Rebbe reads it is that they put them aside and they can never be used again. And this, in fact, proves the exact opposite." Okay, so the Gemara sort of has come to a standstill here. You can't prove anything from this verse in Divrei Hayamim because you don't know which way to read it. So now the Gemara introduced the following attempted proof. So we just started reading this last time. Let's read this again. Lema misayei
alei. Where are we again?
I have to count the lines. It's on. Nun Beis, 11 lines up from where they get wide. So the 11th to last narrow line. Okay, sort of halfway through the line. Lema Misele, can the following prove the Rebbe's perspective that the things become prohibited Hana? Mizrachis Tzonis, Bo Gonzu Beis Chashmonai Es Avne HaMizbeach Sheshiksu Anshe Yavan. So the Mishnah in Midos is describing the construction of an area known as the Ezras Nashim. The Ezras Nashim in the Beis HaMikdash was the area before the real Azara. In other words, you had the main courtyard, and then you had a square area, by the 135 by 135 Amos, that was called the Ezras Nashim. On Sukkot, when they made the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, that's where they used to party, that's where they built a balcony on top. There were four rooms occupying major sections of this Ezras Nashim in each corner. Each corner had a big room, and each room had a purpose. The Mishnah in Midos is about a description of the temple, and its architecture, its construction. The Mishnah says, identifies what were the usages of each of these four rooms. And in talking about the northeastern room, it says, in that room, that's where the Chashmonaim put aside, they were gones, they put in shemos in effect, the stones that the Avnei Mizbeach, that sheshiksu anshe Yavan, that the anshe Yavan, the Greeks, the Seleucids, made shekets. What does that mean? So va'amar av sheshes sheshiksu la'avodas kochavim. They use them for avodah zara in some way. So what you see is that when the Greeks came, and they used the materials, they used the stones in the Mizbeach, they probably used the Mizbeach and sacrificed to idolatry on it, the Mizbeach became prohibited. Now the assumption of the question, as Rashi points out, is that the Greeks who did this had no capacity, did not have the ability to make the Mizbeach usur, because it didn't belong to them. Right? They might even more than that, the Mizbeach is part of the karka. Right? So why is it then that the Hashmonaim, when they won out, why did they remove the stones of the Mizbeach and replace them? Because even though, min HaTorah, the stones of the Mizbeach are not prohibited, they thought it inappropriate that any kalim that were used, any vessels, or any parts of the, anything used in the temple worship was used in an illicit manner, even if the Torah would not prohibit its usage, the Rabbanon decreed that it could not be used. So this would prove that Rebbe's point is correct, that vessels used in the house of Onias, even though it wasn't an idolatrous temple, the Chachamim would have decreed as forbidden. That's what the Gemara suggests. Now is where it gets very interesting. And hence the background before. Amar Rab Papa. Rab Papa says no. That proves nothing. Hasam kra ashgach vidarash. There they found a pasuk and they interpreted it to explain why the stones really were prohibited. What was the pasuk? Dichsiv uva uva pritzim v'chileluha. Now, the pasuk in Yechezkel is making a prediction that the paritzim, which were presumably their enemies, the lewd ones or something like that, would come in and they would desecrate the temple. Now, the way when you learn Yechezkel, if you learn Yechezkel in grade school, you just learn Yechezkel was predicting what was going to happen. How were they going to profane the temple? Well, they do all sorts of things in it. But the Gemara here is saying that, no, we read the word v'chileluha not just as a historical or pragmatic description, but rather as a halachic statement. Chileluha means they will profane it, that it will lose its kedusha. And what this Gemara means is something really fascinating, and you'll see its application in a moment elsewhere, that if the temple, in fact, is desecrated, the way most Rishonim would say, by non-Jews, presumably in a captive act, even things that ordinarily should not become prohibited in Hana, or things that normally should not be yotzei lechulin, that should not be technically profane to lose their kedusha, because it's an act of conquest, it nullifies the kedusha that's found. If you want to see a concept that's somewhat like this, the Gemara has this in Shavuos, the Daf Yomi. If anybody's doing Daf Yomi, it was probably not so long ago. There's a question whether or not the first sanctity of Eretz Yisrael and the Beis HaMikdash were eternal, or when the land was conquered in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, it undid the Kedusha, and when the Jews returned in the time of Cyrus from Persia, from Babylon, so they reconsecrated the temple and Eretz Yisrael and so on. But the Gemara, what seems to be the logic behind the position that what we call Kedusha Rishona, Kidsha L'Shaita, Velo Kidsha L'Asad Lavo, the original sanctity was for its time, but not eternal. The logic behind that position would seem to be that the way Eretz Yisrael originally received its Kedusha was through conquest, and therefore the conquest by the nations will come along and undo the Kedusha. It was sanctified with Kibush, it was profaned with Kibush. The reason why the second coming to Eretz Yisrael is eternal, that Kedusha is eternal, because it wasn't achieved through conquest. It was achieved with the permission of the emperor or the king of Persia, and therefore, because it wasn't through Kibush, Kibush is not capable of nullifying the Kedusha the second time around. So it seems to be here is really the same concept that Yechezkel is presenting, and it's rather interesting that the Gemara is learning this from a Pasuk in Navi. Right? It's very strange. It's a very radical new concept that the Gentiles conquering the temple profanes it. And it's particularly radical because as a Jew, if a Jew intentionally takes an object from the treasury and uses it or steals it, it doesn't lose its kedusha because mi'ila is technically speaking only when it's done b'shogeg. If I accidentally derive benefit from it, then I have to bring a carbon. I have to pay back what I stole plus a fifth, and the object is yotze lechulin. It loses its kedusha unless it's an animal or a ministering vessel. But when I do something b'mezid, I may get lashes. If I steal from hekdesh purposely, I may get lashes. I have to pay back the damages, but I don't have a fifth, and I don't have to bring a sacrifice. There is no sacrifice for that. And the object, the consecrated object, retains its sanctity. So here what you have is the Gentiles intentionally desecrate the temple, but it seems to be it's its own category, that conquest of the temple by the non-Jews, in fact, nullifies the Kedusha. Therefore, what that means in this context is that when the Seleucids defiled the temple, once they conquered it and used it for their own worship, in effect, at least aspects of the Beis HaMikdash lost their Kedusha. If they served on the Mizbeach, if they ministered on the Mizbeach became a Mizbeach l'avodah zarah, and therefore it actually was Aser Bahana, and therefore once the Hasmoneans reconquered the temple, they had to get rid of the stones and put a new Mizbeach in.
So this oil, the oil that they...
Remember, would have been... any of the oil... in that story would be the oil they didn't use, right? Touching would not have been the issue. It's interesting in its own right, not our topic, because that's only tumah, by the way, midrabanan. Just
know. Yayin nesach, you couldn't have shemen nesach.
No, they didn't lie. Firstly, that wasn't the regular libation. Secondly, that's exera midrabanan, which only came later. So the issue with the oil is a very interesting story in its own right, and why any oil should have been usser. If they used the oil in the worship, it wouldn't have been there anymore. But that's not our issue for the moment. But the bottom line is, they ministered on the Mizbeach, and therefore, really, it's usser min HaTorah, and that doesn't prove anything that Rebbe was trying to prove. Marshall.
So, is that really what the concept of Shalolo is deemed initiated? Right or wrong, they now have sovereignty over it.
I think it is something along those lines.
Or
I think so.
Is it specific to Eretz Israel that it's sort of a God's will that we were conquered by foreign nations because of our own chataim, and therefore he allowed the ownership of the temple to turn over other hands? We have to win it back, reclaim it, make it Shalolo again, and only then have to reconstruct.
So I don't think it's unique to this situation. In other words, the particular application in terms of Hekdesh maybe, but the concept that conquest changes the halachic status of an area is not unique to this. The idea that Amon u'Moav tiaru b'Sichon, that the Jews were not allowed to attack Amon or Moav, but the land that Sichon conquered from Moav was fair game, right? Because they conquered it from Sichon. So I think that Chazal talk about the notion of Kinyan Kibush, and it certainly does exist. What's more interesting, that Chazal's concept of Kibush, even though this may not seem fair, it may be a little one-sided in the context of conquering slaves. A Jew is kona a goy, kinyan haguf, not just kinyan damim, the body as well. Whereas a goy, it's said to be, is only kona kinyan adamim, but or something like kinyan masay adayim, and so on. Despite that, the non-Jews entering the temple can do more kinyan, if you want to put it that way, more chilul than a Jew doing it intentionally.
But that, I mean, look, that, I don't think that's actually, I'm not sure that's a relevant analogy, because it's a better analogy to Hekdesh. In other words, just like a behemoth is Hekdesh forever and can't be desanctified,
right,
the concept of a Jew is such that you can't do Kiyana Gufana, even if you actually take over the sovereignty over his body. So that asymmetry, I think, is actually pretty logical if you think about sort of sanctity of...
I'm not sure. I have to go back. When I talk about the goof, I don't mean in that sense. I hear what you're saying. Okay, but nonetheless, put that aside. Just take the straight Me'ila case. The idea that a Jew cannot desecrate in such a way that it's Yotzei L'chulin, but the Gentiles' conquest does. Right? The interesting test case would be, what if the 10 tribes had conquered Jerusalem, let's say in the time of Basho, and then they had desecrated the temple somehow? What would the status have been then, right? It's a Jew doing it, but it's done through conquest, and they didn't recognize the temple because they had their temples in Dan and Basel, whatever it is. Okay. But that's a really radical concept, this idea of Bol Baprit Simechil Law. It's important for another reason we'll see in a moment. But before we get there, now the Gemara has a question. The Gemara says, so what did they do? Amri, they said, Hechin Aved, what are we going to do with the stones? So the way Rashi understands is that, so at this point, they couldn't use them as was in the current state for the... they couldn't use them for the Beis HaMikdash right now because they were Asur Mishem Avodah Zarah. So the first that Rashi says, Amrei hechinav et nitparinu. Why don't we have, doesn't really mean break it. It means have the goy be mevatalit, by breaking it. In other words, take some of your Seleucid conquered slaves, and since they're over there with Zara, they can nullify what happened to the Mizbeach. So nitparinu, and they would do that by breaking it. So Rashi says, the Gemara says, no, because it's that won't work. Avanim shleimos amar rachmana. To reuse them for the Mizbeach would have required whole stones. And if they're broken, that's no good. If it has jagged edges. Then, ninsarinhu, why don't we just shave them down? So the answer is no, that's no good either, because lo sanif alehem barzel amar rachmana. Torah says that you're not allowed to take a metal implement, certainly an iron implement, and use it to cut the stones of the Mizbeach, because iron, metal, is the instrument of death, and the Mizbeach is to bring peace and life into the world. It's a very powerful statement in its own right.
Stones that are smooth.
What's that?
Stones that are naturally smooth.
Right. Today, I think we might be able to use a laser to cut them. But back then, they didn't really have so many choices. They had to find stones that were smooth enough, and then you could. It wasn't just you fit them together and you use some type of material that was holding them together. So, so the Gemara says, what? Vamai? Why did they have to put them away? Litbarinhu, let the guy break them. Bimavatalit. Velishkilinu, lenafshayu. Why didn't they take them for their own use? Okay, you can't use it for the Beis HaMikdash anymore. In fact, arguably, one should have been able to say that even if the guy is mevatalit, and you could physically rebuild them to the Mizbeach, it should have been prohibited anyway. It should be no better than a behemoth that's worshipped. If you worship a behemoth, okay, and you don't get killed, and the behemoth doesn't get killed, you still can't bring it as a carbon. It's not prohibited, bahanah, to a regular person, it just can't be used as a carbon, right? But so the stone, you would have said, even if they were mevatalit, you still couldn't have used them for the Mizbeach. But now the Gemara says differently. Okay, but be mevatal the stones of the Mizbeach that the Greeks defiled, and just sell them to individual people who need them, right? People always needed stones for building stuff. So so why don't they do that? So, and the Gemara says, Mi lo amar raboshaya. Bikshu lignos kol kesef vizav shavolam mishum kaspa vidava sheyirushalayim. So first, Rashi said they wanted to be gones, to prohibit all the gold and the silver in the world. You're not allowed to get any benefit from. Why? Because mixed into it was the gold and silver of Jerusalem that was taken at the time of the destruction of the temple. And a lot of that gold and silver was, in fact, hektesh. It was kodesh. It belonged to the treasury. And therefore, if you use gold today, if I have a gold in my watch, so maybe that gold has some of the treasury gold, and I'm not allowed to get benefit from it. So, it's a very interesting expression. Again, I don't think this is a true historical statement. Bikshu lignos. It was almost like they wanted to. In the same way the Gemara at the end of the third chapter in Baba Basra speaks about the people who wanted to not marry and not reproduce after the destruction of the temple, and Rabbi Yoshua had to engage them and explain to them why that was the wrong approach. Or they said they would never, should never ever drink meat or drink wine or eat meat and so on. So here, they want to, in principle, declare all the gold and the silver in the world prohibited because the Kesef and the Zav of Yushalayim. Now, interruption. This is not correct. Vahavinanba. We analyze this. Yushalayim havia ruba da'alma. What do you mean? Yushalayim is the gold and silver that was in Jerusalem in the temple was a majority of the gold and the silver in the world? No. You should allow gold and silver generally because the majority of it is not doesn't belong to the temple. And we always follow a rove. Yes, it does. The Gemara assumes that. Ella. Amar Abaye, Bikshu lignos dinara hadrayana toriana shifa. Now, they wanted to prohibit the certain kind of gold. The first word there is Hadrian. The second word there is Trajan. It's not clear whether it's the gold of both of them, or apparently Hadrian took Trajan's name. I guess he had as a second name or something, or adopted that name. So it might be one specific coin. And this is from Hadrian of the Hadrianic persecutions. Shifa. That was worn down. In other words, they wanted to be gones all of these coins that if they were worn down, I don't know why only the worn down ones, that it should be prohibited.
If it's raised, you can't use it.
What's that?
If it's a raised image.
No, let's assume it wasn't Avodah Zarah. Maybe it had an image. It was just known. It must have been a coin, I assume, that was minted in honor of his victory and his slaughtering of the Jews. So it wasn't an idolatrous coin, but they should be prohibited. Nay, Tivasha Yerushalayim. They wanted to prohibit it because of the gold of Yerushalayim, that it belonged to the Beis HaMikdash. And there, it sounds like they're assuming that he deliberately took the gold and silver from Yerushalayim and melted it down to make these coins as an in-your-face, to the Jews he had conquered. Ad shematzu la mikra min haTorah, until they found a pasuk in the Torah, it's not really in the Torah, shumutar, that it's permitted, which is the same verse in Yechezkel. Uva uva paritzim v'chilaluha. Alright? Which means that once the Romans conquered Jerusalem, once they, through conquest, they captured these materials and they reused them, it became profaned, it became mechulal, it no longer had sanctity once they did that, and therefore you don't have to worry even about the Hadrianic coins, because they too are permitted. So the Gemara wants to know, I'll take a question, the Gemara wants to know, why didn't they do that with the stones of the Mizbeach as well? We'll answer in a moment. Marshall?
Just in case it's irrelevant, I think that Trajan actually adopted Hadrian in the last 48 hours of his life. And there's actually a debate about whether his wife did it in his name and he was already not.
Okay.
Or whether he did it for the
stability of Roman Empire. Okay. But they talk about the taking of the name.
Yeah.
And Hadrian was the successor. Hadrian was the one who we know much more who did the real damage, although there were some uprisings during Trajan as well, which didn't end well. I think that was probably more in the diaspora. So again, I don't know if this is two names or one name here, but either way, so the Gemara wants to know why couldn't they use the stones of the Mizbeach for their own purposes? Have a guy be mevatel it. I know you can't use it as part of the new Mizbeach. Why did they have to put them in Geniza in this room, you know, hide them away in this room in the temple? So the Gemara says, I'll tell you why. Hasam lo ishtamish behu lagavoa. The reason why they allowed the gold and silver to be used by a regular person is because that wasn't actually used in the service of God. It was just money in the temple treasury. However, hacha keva and ishtamish behu lagavoa. These were stones used. They were in the Mizbeach. You think about the sanctity they once possessed and how they were used. Lav orach ara lishtamushe buhadyota. It's not appropriate to have a regular person use these stones. But nonetheless, it doesn't prove Rebbe's point. In other words, the fact that these stones weren't used was not because the Chachamim decreed that things that, even though they're permitted in HaTorah to be used in the Mikdash, we don't allow them if they were once used in other worship, because in this case, the stones really were not allowed to be used in the Beis HaMikdash because they were used for Avodah Zarah in a way that they actually became prohibited. Why? Even though the stones, the Mizbeach, did not belong to the Seleucids, nonetheless, when they conquered the temple and they desecrated it and they used it for Avodah Zarah, that's Uva Uva Paritzim V'Chilaluha. So that's how the Gemara concludes this particular section, with the issue unresolved. But I think that what is most interesting about this is this question, this notion of conquest, and Marshall raises the broader question of where, in what situations does conquest undo the status, the legal status of something, in this particular case, the sanctity. One interesting and very powerful homiletical source, which actually runs to the contrary, is Rambam's position. Rambam's position is that even though the Gemara has a debate about the original sanctity of the land of Israel, whether Kedusha Rishona was permanent or it was undone, and then it was the second Kedusha that became permanent, the Rambam says that that only applies to Eretz Yisrael. It does not apply to the Kedusha of the Beis HaMikdash. And the reason the Rambam says is that the reason why the Beis HaMikdash was Kadosh was because of the Shechina, and the Shechina is never betela. The Divine Presence is never nullified, and therefore the Kedusha of the Mikdash, once Shlomo endowed it with its sanctity, it was really the Shechina that endowed it, and therefore the Beis HaMikdash was Kedusha Rishona, Kidsha L'Shaita, it was for its time, V'Kidsha L'Selavo, and it was actually eternal. Which really runs a little bit contrary in some ways to this notion, but that only applies, there's no real contradiction in the sense that that only applies to the land itself. The area itself remains consecrated, that area which was the Holy of Holies, the Kodesh HaKadashim, retains that sanctity, the area that was the Azara, where no person who's impure may enter, retains that sanctity wherever it is on the Temple Mount, and that doesn't change, whereas all of the building materials, theoretically, if one were to find the building materials, you know, stones that might have been originally part of the temple, maybe they would be permitted because of the concept of Vava Paritzim Mechilulah. Marshall?
Leaving Kalamashini aside, was the Shemon Esrei already largely in its final form as a panorama?
Yeah, it certainly was. In its final form.
So how do you think he felt about the Abinei Chazir Shkinetzal and Tzion three times a day if his position was that it never left?
So I think the simple explanation, I could give a lumdish explanation, but I think the simple explanation is that even though the Divine Presence is still there, it's not manifest when the holy city is in the hands of the heathens. right? And the temple is in ruins. So even though God's presence is still there, nonetheless, it's not manifest for mankind to see. That's what being Masa Shechina. What is the Shechina? In fact, the Shechina is the divine manifestation that we call the physical presence, kivayachol, of God in the world. So even though the Shechina is lo betela, means God's actual presence, not betela, our ability to see it, in fact, is hidden. Okay. Yes.
I assume that all these ideas, they don't carry over to Shul's Beis Knesset.
So Beis HaKnesset is a very good question. It has its own rules in terms of, it certainly is a notion of sanctity, specifically when you talk about objects that don't have inherent sanctity. If you think about it, I don't know if anybody's ever, it's the first time I've ever thought in this light, in you're asking the question, I don't know if anybody's written these terms. If you think about a shul, there are two, you also have what I'll call things that have Kedushas HaGuf and things that have Kedushas Damim, meaning the Sifrei Torah in a shul have Kedusha Sagof. They will always have Kedusha, right? You can't take away the Kedusha of a Sefer Torah. It is what it is, right? It, almost everything else in the shul, theoretically, is really as Tashmishe Kedusha, we would call it, have things that maybe could have the sanctity removed. The question is, under what circumstances can that happen? I actually don't remember, like, can the shul, so I know that the means by which we decommission things, I think that the Gemara speaks about and the Shulchan Aruch speaks about, is the Shiva Tovei Ha'ir. The Shiva Tovei Ha'ir was ostensibly the town council, the seven elders of the city. And if they thought for the needs of the city, it was important to desacralize something, you know, and receive money for communal needs, so I think they are permitted to do so. They can certainly do so for the Beis HaKnesses. There does seem to be some type of prohibition that you're not allowed to sell a Beis HaKnesses for certain purposes that were really, really not nice, like you couldn't sell it to be a latrine or something like that. And even that is a question, under what circumstances might you be able to sell for all purposes. And you certainly can, you can sometimes sell a Sefer Torah, although it's frowned upon, but the Sefer Torah always retains its Kedusha. So there are means also of de-sanctifying a Beis HaKnesses, certainly. And in some ways, there probably are some parallels to the Beis HaMikdash, but obviously not exactly the same. The kedusha of a Beis HaKnesses is not the same, even though we call it a Mikdash Mad. It's obviously not the same as the kedusha of the Beis HaMikdash.
And for example, like matzevas that were taken by the Nazis or others and used just like that. They lose their sanctity.
So that's a question that I don't know the answer to, but that's a very different question, because the first question you have to ask is, what is the status of a matzeva? If it in fact is considered a monument on a tombstone, if it's really Asur Bahana, then I'm not sure that it's an interesting question. Would that actually change? Would that change if someone took it and desecrated it? If it's only Osir because of Kavod Hames, it's more likely we'll say that if they took the stones and they paved them and they built the road with it and it's basically sort of gone and you can't see it anymore, then it might not be Osir. But if it was, remember, we dealt with that type of a case with the stones of Marcellus, right? They took the stones and they used them, you know, to make the road. And the question is, what? And the question is, are you allowed to use them or not? And there was a machlokas that some Amorim would walk on the road, some would walk on the road, and that was the question of whether bittul worked by the stones and what their status was. So normally we don't say about Yisurei Hana that they are in fact batel. In other words, Kedusha is betela, but a prohibition about to say, you know, something that's Asur B'Hana, we don't usually assume ever loses its status, you know, of Hana. So if in fact the tombstone is really genuinely Asur B'Hana, I'm not sure that we would say that just because they desecrated it, that those stones would be Motor B'Hana. You know, so of course, you'd have to be able to know how they were used and so on. Okay. Let's at least start the next sugya. We'll read the Mishnah. It's a very, very interesting Mishnah. If you were to pull a Talmud Yerushalmi off the shelf, you would see that the text of the Mishnah is actually different than this now. Many times there are differences in various manuscripts of the Mishnah, but this is one of two cases that I'm aware of in Shas where the difference in the two versions of the Mishnah have to do with the fact that Rebbe, when he was younger, taught the Mishnah in one version, and then later in his life he changed his mind and he taught the Mishnah differently. In both cases, the Yerushalmi has what is called what the Bavli calls the earlier version, and the Bavli's Mishnah was what you have as the later version. Now, if you look at the Yerushalmi here, the Gemara of the Yerushalmi also makes clear that Rebbe changed his mind. In other words, there's no debate, but this is not the Babylonians think their version is superior. This both are aware of the historical change. The other case where we have this is the fourth parak of Bava Metzia. I don't know how many of you remember what the name of the fourth parak of Bava Metzia is, but for those of you who maybe remember from Daf Yomi, it wasn't so long ago, you learned it once, it happens to be known as Parak HaZahav. The Mishnah begins, HaZahav Kona Es HaKesef. It's dealing with, we believe that if you pay money for something, it doesn't become your object until you actually take possession. You make a kinyan, and either party, in theory, can really back out. And when you exchange two different kinds of coinage, the Mishnah is concerned with what is considered in that context currency, and what's considered chattel. And it's which one is Kona. In other words, if you want to sell me your radio, and I haven't paid you money yet, but I make a kinyan on the radio, the radio is mine, I owe you the money, neither party can back out. So the Mishnah is dealing with what's Kona what. The Nusach that we have, the version we have in our Mishnah, is HaZahav Kona Sakesef, and people will learn it, say we're learning Perek HaZahav. Right, the first word of the parak. If you open up the early manuscripts from Eretz Yisrael, the Mishnayis, and you open up any Talmud Yerushalmi, the name of the parak is Perek HaKesef. Because the original Nusach that Rebbe taught was HaKesef Kona Es HaZahav, Ve'en HaZahav Kona Es HaKesef. Later in his life, he changed his mind, and he said, HaZahav Kona Es HaKesef, Ve'en HaKesef Kona Es HaZahav. That is the later version of the Mishnah. The same thing happened here with a different detail. And the question here, which we'll explore a little bit more next week, is there any situation where the Avodah Zarah of a Jew can in fact be batel? Can a guy, under certain circumstances, nullify the Avodah Zarah of a Jew? Now, if you've been here a while, and most of the Shirim you know at this point, that one of the cardinal rules we've worked with is that an Avodah Zarah of a guy can be misbatel. It can be nullified by a guy, by any guy who worships Avodah Zarah, but the Avodah Zarah of a Jew, once a Jew worships it, it becomes prohibited forever. There's no way to undo that prohibition. But that is, in fact, the later version of the Mishnah. The earlier version read differently. So our Mishnah says as follows. Oved kolchavim, mevatel avodas kolchavim shelo v'shel chaveiro. A Jew, a guy, may be mevatel avodas zarah his own, and of a fellow guy, but by implication, not of a fellow Jew. V'Yisrael, ein mevatel avodas kolchavim shel oved kolchavim. But a Jew cannot be mevatel avodas zarah of a guy, and he certainly can't be mevatel avodas zarah of a Jew. The original version that Rebbe taught when he was younger, if you look in the Gemara, just we'll read the opening of the Gemara. Masnei the Rebbe, the Rebbe Shimon Barebi, or Bere. Rebbe taught his son Rebbe Shimon the following Mishnah. Oved kolchavim mevatel avodas kolchavim shelo v'shel chaveiro. Just what we read in the Mishnah. Amar lei. Rebbe, he said, my master, Shanisa lanu b'yal dusecha, when you were younger, you taught us, Oved kolchavim, mevatel avodas kolchavim shelo v'shel Yisrael. When you were younger, you taught us that a guy can mevatel his avodas zarah and a Jew's avodas zarah. The discussion will go on from there. But that's what there was the original nusach that Rebbe taught, and then he changed his mind. And even that, the Gemara is going to explore what exactly he meant by that. And then this is the later version that a guy can be mevatel his avodas zarah and of another guy, the avodas zarah of a Jew under no circumstances has any kind of bittel. And then the Mishnah concludes by stating, ha mevatel avodas kochavim, mevatel misham sheha. If you have an avodas zarah and it has klei shares, it has ministering vessels, it has mishamshim, and you are mevatel the avodas zarah, it's automatically assumed that the mishamshim are betelim as well. However, bitel mishamshel, if you're mevatel the censer, is that it? If you're mevatel the censer that was used to burn incense to the thing, the avodah zarah itself remains prohibited. Only the thing that you are mevatel, the mishamish, the ministering vessel, that becomes batel. Okay.